This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. As the wealth gap grows and job markets deteriorate, people are turning to alternatives to the global corporate business model. One alternative is cooperatively owned businesses. The main principle of a cooperative organization is to give ownership to the people who do the work. It's not a new idea. For African-American communities, cooperative economics historically has meant survival. And while co-ops have played an important part in African-American history, it's a story that is not often told. Jessica Gordon-Nempart writes the history of African-American cooperatives and cooperative economics in her book called Collective Courage. She's an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at the City University of New York and joins me now on the State of Things. Jessica, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi. Good morning. Afternoon now.
Just turned afternoon. You talk about cooperatives, and of course there are many different kinds of cooperatives. There are producer cooperatives and worker cooperatives and that sort of thing. But in general, when we talk about cooperatives, what are we talking about? How are they distinct from other kinds of businesses?
Right. So as you said, there are companies that are owned by the people who form them, which kind of sounds silly, but the purpose of a co-op is to satisfy a need. So a food co-op, that's an easy one. People want healthy, accessible food. Electric co-ops, you want access to electricity. Usually it's not profitable for a for-profit company to go into that business. And so for a co-op, people come together, they see the need, they form a business around it. And then the real difference is that it's one person, one vote, not one share, one vote. And so you get this economic democratic participation where you have everybody part of the governance being able to make the rules. So it's sort of you pool your resources, share the risks, and then you also share the profits and decide democratically how to run the company and what to do with the profits.
And there's a simple point that you make, but it's a fascinating one and one we should focus on, that the co-op is formed to serve a need, not
right.
necessarily to generate wealth. So
right.
it's not, hey, here's an idea that I can make millions on. It's, we need electricity. How
right.
are we going to get it? We need food. In African-American communities, both before and after the Civil War, this was vital because there weren't many other
right.
agencies serving those
They didn't
needs.
Have many options, especially because they were either enslaved, so they didn't even own their own bodies, or those who weren't enslaved were still on the bottom of the rung. They were discriminated against. So they started actually mutual aid societies first, which were sort of precursors to co-ops. And those are where you all come together, see what you need. Like if you need burial, everybody puts in dues, and then that dues combined can pay for whoever needs to be buried at that time. And so then you can cover your costs that way. They did it also to buy freedom. They did it. The Underground Railroad is another example. And then they gradually developed real formal business relationships that were using the co-op. International co-op principles.
So talk about that. Let's talk about the 1880s, because this is really a defining moment for cooperatives and
yes.
that model. What's going on then?
Well,
I mean, I think if
I'm
you go,
trying to think of the short way
right.
to talk about it, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time
right.
here. But the 1880s, I actually talk about as a period when populism, unionization, and the co-op movements all were kind of birthing and coalescing. And so the union movement realized it had to be integrated because you couldn't fight for white worker rights if you were exploiting black workers or didn't connect with the black workers. The populists, the black and the white populists, knew that you had to have some kind of political alliance. And the co-ops were trying to do economic transformation and economic justice. At that time, groups like the Knights of Labor were actually doing all that. They were organizing workers, but workers to own their own land, to own their own cotton mills, their own factories, et cetera, because they realized that real liberation for labor was in ownership. So for a while, those three movements really worked together and were integrated. But because it was also the period right after Reconstruction where the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacy and segregation and Jim Crow had just resurfaced in a virulent way, most of those projects had to go underground, were very much under attack, meaning leaders lynched, buildings burned, crops ruined, railroads not willing to even transport co-ops crops, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I think this is an important point. The Knights of Labor were very successful in creating these co-ops. They were big businesses. In fact, I think one story you tell is remarkable to me. The Richmond City Hall is built by a cooperative under the auspices of Knights of Labor.
Right. So they're really doing a lot of work at that period. And as I said, they're kind of combining all those issues into one group, but they're totally under assault. They're also the first labor organization to recognize women, and one of their first women leaders is a co-op. She believes in the co-op commonwealth. She wants us to be able to create a whole co-op commonwealth. But by the late 1880s, they have to disband because they're just under so much assault and they can't operate. Smaller groups then take over the same mantle, and then eventually the integration has to separate, and then the combination of all those three sort of separates so that by the 20th century, those are all separate, segregated and separate.
Yeah, and as you say, the capitalists are making an assault. The bank-led capitalists, though, so railroads aren't refused to ship their goods. So anything produced by a co-op, we're not going to do it. So now that's the business assault. Politically, it's interesting, too. We start to see legislation that's hurting co-ops, and particularly with regard to the integration that was racial integration.
Right. So you can't – well, even during Knights of Labor, blacks and whites couldn't be at the same meeting together. So that Richmond example you have, they had a black chapter and a white chapter. They had the same exact project and issues, but they had to meet in different rooms or in different places because whites and blacks couldn't sit together. So they were already fighting that, but eventually they had to do separate organizations. So you eventually have the Colored Farmers Cooperative Union. I think a Colored Farmers National Cooperative Union. I forgot the exact name, but that's just a black organization that's also a populist political organization, and then it's a union, and then they're also doing co-op development among blacks particularly, but they also eventually have to go underground and then disband.
So what's the impact of that? Talk about kind of what happens when these assaults finally result in the dissolution of many co-ops.
Right. Well, one of the lasting legacies is that people get discouraged. I think I start the book saying that there's this long and strong history, but it's quite hidden. And if it's told at all, it's told as failure, which isn't actually true. In fact, I think that's the only time in the book I use the word failure, because I don't believe in telling these histories as a failure. Because when you look at any of the examples, there's lots of learning, lots of progress that gets made. People get jobs, people are able to own homes, feed themselves, etc., through these co-ops, even when they're short-lived, even when the leaders get lynched or whatever. So it's not really failure, but they're told as failure. So even like the Colored Farmers, they lasted, 4 or 5 years, had I don't know how many, 5 or 6 co-op stores, and did lending so blacks could get their own homes and land. But because they're under so much assault, they're considered a failure because they couldn't last longer or do more.
And not only does this meet a need, as you say, if nobody's going to, if banks won't lend to African American people, we will lend to each other.
Right.
If we can't have a store in our neighborhood, we will build our own grocery store.
Right.
It meets a need, but then it also, because we're the owners, allows you to build wealth. It's not just income. This is equity. This is ownership.
So even though, their main purpose is not wealth, a consequence, a good side consequence, or what we call a spillover, is also wealth because, you end up having equity, an asset, you own an asset. The other thing is, even though we say not for profit, we don't mean that there aren't profits.
Right.
We just mean the mission is not to make profits, but any business has to have surplus.
Well, it's generative wealth. So the wealth goes into the community and the stakeholders rather than extractive wealth,
exactly.
Which means an absentee shareholder who may not care about the health of my community benefits and profits by, in fact, some of the practices.
Right. So the co-op allows you to keep recirculating among the members and among the community and keep using it for what it's needed, and then it builds wealth in that sense.
And it didn't just end in the 1880s and 1890s.
No.
I think the example of the Black Star Line developed by Marcus Garvey's in the early 20th century. Tell us that story.
Right. So that one's actually another one that ends badly but starts off really well. It's a share stock company. It never really gets to be a co-op in terms of full democratic ownership, but it's $5 a share for people to buy into a shipping line that's going to ship goods and people from the U.S., Caribbean to Africa and back, and so to create commerce between blacks, basically Pan-African commerce. It does really well in terms of people put a lot of money into it. They had three ships, but it's not managed well, and unfortunately Garvey is under assault for his activism, his black nationalism, and he gets in jail for mail fraud, actually, for trying to sell the shares over through the mail. And so eventually it ends. But Garvey's biographers talk about the larger vision was this another sort of co-op commonwealth idea. They had some Negro factories, they called them. They were also buying into some factories. And the notion was Pan-African ownership of businesses that would then connect people to Africa, but also keep money circulating within the black community.
Well, it's precisely that vision that brought him to the attention of the authorities, and
right.
ultimately the persecution ends in the dissolution. But as you say, the idea keeps coming back, and it is here with us even today.
Yes.
The cooperative organizations still serve as a means of survival and meeting the needs of underserved communities. Joining the conversation now is John Jones. He's president of the board of directors of the Renaissance Community Co-op. It's a grocery store still in development in Northeast Greensboro. John, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So tell us about the idea for this co-op. What will the Renaissance Co-op do? Why? Where did the idea come from?
The idea came from a group that had already been formed in our city. And with the help of F4DC, a community-based group, that came out and said, you are trying to get a grocery store in your neighborhood. One won't come. We have been designated as a food desert. So he said, you can do it yourself. And they planted in our idea, in our minds, the idea of forming a co-op. We started out with a steering committee who did basic study. From that, we got a board of directors. And here we are now within 6 to 8 months of owning our own store in our neighborhood where the profit will stay.
Well, where it stays right there. Now, the workers don't own this, right? The community has invested
in this. The community.
Is.
Right? We have, at the present, we have 640 owners.
Mm-hmm. That's fabulous.
Yeah, who have bought in and invested. So you're either a member, you can make an investment in this. But it's a kind of a slow money investment, you're right. So there's a fixed return on your investment, and the membership fee is a one-time fee. Talk about what was there, because there was a Winn-Dixie.
It was a Winn-Dixie food store was there that left in 1998.
Mm. All right. Now, so here's a supermarket that was there and closed.
Right.
That could be a warning sign, right? Why did they say they closed?
They did not close because of not making a profit. They made a profit. They closed because they wanted to be a bigger store, and the space was not available. So they moved from one location to another. Then they left the state entirely.
Hmm. And this can be, Jessica, you know, the corporations that are headquartered elsewhere can make these decisions for a lot of reasons. If I have to cut costs,
right.
I'll look at the least two performing stores in my chain. I'll cut them. That doesn't mean they weren't making money, but it leaves your neighborhood, John, in a lurch without a store. And
right.
so that becomes the kind of economic. It's not that you can't make money selling
right.
groceries in your neighborhood.
Right.
It's that the corporate model doesn't serve the needs of the neighborhood.
Right.
Right.
And also, John actually has great statistics about how much money leaves, even if the corporate station stays, like a supermarket.
Right.
They leave about 5% of what they earn
in your neighborhood,
yeah. and they take all the rest out. It goes to their headquarters, yeah. their managers who don't live in your neighborhood, that kind of thing. So we want a model where the neighbors, the community, decides what to do with the business and gets to keep as much of the profits and the money circulating in the neighborhood.
And, John, you talked about the research you did, and
yes.
you found just how many customers you do have nearby
yes,
and how much they spend, right?
Yes. In our neighborhood, there are 37,000 families that live within 2.5 miles of our store, and they spend $1.3 million a week on groceries.
Imagine keeping that money in the neighborhood.
And so we are hoping just to get a percentage of that within our neighborhood to stay, and our owners get an opportunity to share in what is done with the money. Also, they get a discount, and they get a chance to vote on the board of directors.
So you might not have a volunteer job in a couple of weeks if things don't go right.
The 19th is our first annual meeting, and I'm up for re-election.
For all the hard work you've done, I don't think you'll have any trouble, because it is hard work, and I want to ask you about that. You heard Jessica say, if this story is told at all, it's told in terms of failure. Was it difficult initially for you to sort of sell this concept? How did the neighbors meet your idea?
First, you have to get the people to trust you and to trust your idea and to buy into your idea that this will work. And once we found how that being transparent and sharing with the neighbors and with the owners, they bought into the idea. But it's hard to show them something that they cannot see.
Jessica, talk about how hard this is, or is the idea catching on? Is there new traction now in African-American communities for developing co-ops?
Yes. Actually, I've been learning since I published the book last year that there's lots and lots of traction everywhere. I mean, I've been going to black communities, Minnesota, the Bay Area, L.A., Florida, New Orleans, Grand Rapids, Michigan. I mean, just everywhere. People, the Black Lives Matters groups are contacting me because they want solutions. So everybody's really trying to think about alternatives, I think partly because of the Great Recession, partly because they're just ready for more community control again. They see things going out of control. I did want to mention a couple things in terms of the legacy is really a continuous history. So even though we really only got to the 1920s, after the 1880s, the 1930s was a huge period, and then even the 60s and 70s. And some of the important connections between those periods of lots of activity were having organizations, black organizations that were talking about co-op development and training people in co-op development and helping people to connect with other people who were doing it, and also partly the need, either the economic need or a sense of solidarity need. And so those kind of things, when they coalesced, you had more co-ops, but we've always had some throughout the history.
Well, and along those lines, our own Ella Baker, we call her our own since she was raised in North Carolina, was instrumental in this in the 1930s and all around this question or this issue of education.
Right.
That was all a big part of the sort of building the co-op economies.
Yes. Ella Jo Baker was the first executive director, actually the only executive director of the Young Negroes Cooperative League. She was in Harlem at the time, actually, but she traveled all over the country, particularly in the South, doing co-op education. They had conferences, meetings. She actually spoke about the role of women in co-ops, which is very important. And so I honestly believe that she really cut her teeth on co-ops, and all the other things we know about her are from her experience in co-ops and that democratic participation and how important grassroots leadership development and all those things come out of people who get involved in co-ops.
John, are you finding any more momentum now in the neighborhood from those first days when you raised the question?
We are constantly at this time now averaging 2 to 3 new members each week. Mm-hmm. We are in the process of signing a lease, and also the building construction has started.
Great.
And with the building construction starting, new interest has peaked.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do a membership drive real soon again. We are hoping in April of this year, of next year, of opening our store with 1,000 members. Huh. We are at 640 now.
You're going to do it.
Yeah.
Keep up the good
That's
work.
Great.
Keep
Thank
up
you.
The good
That's
work.
Great.
Thank you so much. John Jones, president of the board of directors at Renaissance Community Co-op in Greensboro. Jessica Gordon Nemphart is an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at City University in New York. Her book is called Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up next, Jack the Radio live in our studio. Stay with us on The State of Things.